from talk to rock and everything in between. The best variety is right here on the OmniSound Radio 1 Network.
Ghost hunting, my ethereal anti-drug.
Ghostly Talk. Dr. Jim Haran is an author, public speaker, and 16-year veteran in the field of research and clinical psychology. Dr. Haran's award-winning research has been featured by several media outlets and programs including the Discovery Channel, Annie, BBC, NBC's Today Show, Wilson Quarterly, USA Today, New Scientist, Psychology Today, and Rolling Stone.
Previously, Dr. Haran served as an instructor of clinical psychiatry at Southern Illinois School of Medicine and worked as a therapist and, thankfully, a mental health counselor. Thankfully for us, then.
Yeah, okay, we're going to need it.
He received a doctorate in psychology from Adelaide University and completed extracurricular graduate work for the psychology department at the University of Illinois in Springfield, where he received his master's in clinical psychology. Dr. Haran received a bachelor's in psychology from Benedictine University. Welcome to Ghostly Talk, Dr. Haran.
Thank you, guys. How are you?
We've had better days. We're all pretty tired right now.
We have you on.
Oh, are you? Okay. I mean,
we have you on.
Hunting, or what's the deal?
Oh, I wish.
I wish.
There's
you
nothing
wish.
Enough
okay.
of that. You know, here, we're in the Detroit area, and it's been a rainy, wet weekend. So we'd have to do all of our ghost hunting
yeah.
on the inside.
And there's these
hey,
things.
That's great, though. Rainy weather, that sets the mood.
In the fall. In the spring, it's just miserable.
We've done those type of investigations, though, Jim, where we stuck it out. And no matter what weather, we stuck it out.
Do you remember when we tested our cameras?
Oh yeah, and our fingers literally were.
We could have been admitted for frostbite.
Our hands were literally hurting with pain of frostbite.
Really?
Yeah.
Talk about cold spots, huh?
All of Southeast Michigan was one.
Well, this was
cold
like
spot.
This was like 187 years ago or something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, that was back when they first invented cameras.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah. we got these cameras and we're like, okay, these things take pictures, right?
So we're gonna run out to a cemetery.
Yeah, let's try it.
It was a bitter cold.
Yeah, we were so excited.
So we've stuck it out in bad weather before, yeah.
Yes. And
to be commended.
Thank you.
Oh, and of course, who could forget the blizzard of, 3 years ago?
The blizzard
in Jackson?
Of 2003 or 2000.
Oh, my God.
That was horribly painful.
All night.
Rain, we've done
okay,
rain, too.
If you guys are ghost hunting in blizzards, you do need mental health care. It's clear. I come at the right time
yes,
to save
you
your soul. Yes.
I'm telling you, it was was insane.
In defense of our mental capabilities.
That's too late for that. I'm sorry.
We drove an hour to get to where we were going that night.
Yes, we did.
So
in a blizzard? So you
No. I swear to God.
You're not helping your case.
It wasn't snowing on the way there. It was okay. It was all right.
Well, it was a little slippery, but it was okay.
Yeah, but it was like...
A little slippery? So like a little pregnant? What is this?
It was actually... if I remember this trip precisely, I remember Will got in my car, and I'm like, okay, look, it's kind of wet out here, man, but we need to get there, like, fast. So just close your eyes and go to sleep, and if you don't wake up, then you know what happened. All right? So,
oh, yes, okay.
Thankfully,
assuming there's life after death, yes.
Right.
Okay. I always
right.
tell people we hydroplane from, like, you know, one side of the state to the other pretty much because we were flying.
Well, the unfortunate part of that legend is it's only one day a year.
Mm-hmm. Right?
So you have to go on that day, rain, snow,
well, that's what I like to ask Jim, too.
Flood.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I hope it was worth it. What did you find out?
That, you know, you get really cold in shorts in, like, 0-degree weather.
I could have helped you again. I could have given you an answer to that before you went out.
Where were you, man?
But that's okay. You know, it's all about, you know, learning from experience. So.
Exactly.
I learned that the Sunoco, what was it, hot chocolate? From the local
that
gas
stuff
station.
Actually coats your stomach.
It turns solid.
It does. It turns completely solid.
Whatever chemical they use, I
think it was a coagulant.
So again, science takes a huge step forward.
Yeah, absolutely.
Off a
absolutely.
Cliff, apparently. But
that was insane. Yeah.
Jim, that is a question. Speaking of that, I mean, I'd like to know what your take is on that. There are these things we refer to, and I say this, and I hate doing this, but I do it in quotes. Legends, right? They're all over the place. A lot of them have the same trait characteristics. You know, if you do this for a little while, you start to see the patterns, right? Like honk your horn three times, flash your lights, jump up and down with your boxer shorts on, whatever it may be.
Yeah.
There is something you need to do. How much experience have you had with this? I'm just curious.
Well, I guess I do things a little bit differently. When I go out to do an investigation, if I do one, it's always with the scientific method in mind. Not to say what you guys didn't. I mean, I'm not familiar with what you did that night or that day or whatever. And it was a blizzard. Maybe you weren't either. But the fact is, when I go out to investigate something, I'm always there to test hypotheses. And that's it. I'm there to test a hypothesis, and that's it. But what you're talking about with you know, you have to do this set of activities or this ritual to get an effect, that's quite popular.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, that wouldn't surprise some of the scientists that I've worked with. One in particular, James McLennan,
mm-hmm.
he's an anthropologist, and he would say that there's a little bit of a shaman in all of us.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, with shamanism, it's all about ritual. Ritual enacts a special experience in a person. Sometimes that experience can be shared among followers, but oftentimes it's a private experience. So what we're seeing with these urban legends and these other kind of ghost stories where you have to enact something, or you have to be at a location to have the same set of circumstances that led to the haunt in the first place,
mm-hmm.
That's quite common,
mm-hmm.
although I've never heard of something working.
Well, here's an idea that we had thrown at us a while ago. What?
The only working... hold on to your idea one
second. Yeah, no problem. Yeah.
The only working thing that I ever ran into has to be the ghost lights.
Okay, in Indiana.
We went to Indiana. There's a thing called Spooklight Hill.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And all you have to do is physically be there. You don't have to honk or jump up and down or twirl three times or put your clothes on backwards or anything.
Well, that's what I was doing wrong. Okay.
All you have to do is physically be there and watch and observe. And soon enough, you see these dancing lights.
But that really isn't tied in any type of... Well, I guess it may be
a legend.
Yeah,
but
legend.
A lot of those things are tied to ghost legends, although they seem to be
farmer,
a type of geomagnetic phenomenon.
Well, farmer, daughter, head, boy. You know, farmer, daughter, boy, head. It could be meaning a lopped-off head someone's in search of, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's usually what goes with the ghost lights. I don't know if that's
at least in Indiana.
A specific one for Indiana, but
mm-hmm.
that is the train conductor head is the popular one with other ghost lights.
Well, yeah.
So,
for example, the Brown Mountain lights, which is
mm-hmm.
near the Research Triangle, I believe, you know, that goes back to Indian legend. So, these phenomena have been with us for so long. And again, speak to the universal appeal of it, as well as the fact that people will create wonderful stories to explain things that immediately they can't explain.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what a lot of my research actually points to, that if there is an underlying phenomena at work in all haunt, poltergeist, or apparition cases, it's this, that people are trying to create a story to make sense of something that they can't at the time.
Well,
now, that doesn't mean that what happened wasn't parapsychological. It just means that they can't explain it.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's one thing that our brains were programmed to do, if there's one sentence that captures entirely what our brains do, it's this, to make things more certain. And human beings are wonderful at creating stories and explanations, because if we don't, we like to be masters of our environments. We like to be in control psychologically and physically. And if we are in a situation or we face a circumstance that makes us feel uneasy because we're out of control,
mm-hmm.
we will regain that control by creating an explanation.
That makes a whole lot of sense right there, too. Because that's very,
well,
I mean, I agree with that 100%.
And I know
it's mathematically proven. I mean, that's the kind of cool thing about this stuff. With the scientific method, certainly we don't know everything.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever I'm at a party and I hear someone say, well, ghosts are all BS,
mm-hmm.
I am the one to jump in and say, well, really? Well, have you heard about this case? And when someone says ghosts are absolutely real, I'm the one to jump in and say, oh, really? Have you heard of this case that debunks it?
Mm-hmm.
So I go both ways. Certainly there's a class of phenomena that science has not yet understood. However, from my research and my take on the wealth of real scientific research into these phenomena,
mm-hmm.
both through field studies, questionnaires, and reanalyses of past parapsychological data, I think that these experiences tell us more about the living than they do the dead.
And that's a trend I've been seeing, too.
Over the past 3.5 weeks. Yeah.
Well, yeah. it's been a month.
Blizzard wearing off.
I'm getting feeling back in my fingers.
It's been a month like that where a lot of people have been saying similar things like that, whereas a lot of it may have to do with us.
Okay, I don't always myself necessarily have to explain everything, and I know that might not be mathematical, but that's
well, I can.
I don't ever have to explain everything, and I think it all stems from, or it started when I was in junior high and I was up north and I had this dream, and it really affected me because I totally remember it, and I was laying on a surface. It was this huge bedspread, and this bedspread went out forever. There was no end in any direction.
Mm-hmm.
And there were waves being created from underneath the bedspread. And I was just laying, on my back on this bedspread in my dream. and it would be like some big hand was poking. And it would just poke and poke, and it was random, and it would poke up, and it would create these waves. And I had to, my whole purpose in life in this dream was to ride this wave, and or ride these waves, and be, physically just be there on the bedspread. And that's one of the only things that, that gives me a, you know, the like people say when they go on the roller coasters, and they get that flippy feeling in their stomach.
Yeah,
right. I don't get it on roller coasters. I get it in elevators, and I had it in that dream, but I never get that flippy feeling in on roller coasters. I just don't. I know what to expect. You can see it coming. But but in this dream, I was not in control of the finger point, you know, poking up and creating these waves. It was someone else's or something else's finger doing the waves. It was not my thing, and my whole job was just to ride it out and be there. And it was a very short dream, but it definitely left a huge impression on me in that I, ever since then, I just don't think I have to explain everything. Not even with a mythology.
Well, let me make two comments on that.
Okay.
First, you've already explained that. You keep calling it a dream.
Right.
So you already have an explanation. It's not like you had an experience that was so far out that you didn't even have words to describe it.
Right.
You call it a dream.
Mm-hmm.
So there's nothing strange or mystical about that, it seems. That's my impression from hearing you talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
You may be a little, you know, still unsure of what it may mean, but it was a dream to you. And second, let me go a little bit deeper on what we mean by having an explanation. There's a little personality trait that we call tolerance of ambiguity. And in the psych world, we can measure it in many different ways. But basically, normal, everyday people know it as this. People that are extremely intolerant of ambiguity, well, you don't have to be Matlock or a specially trained psychologist to see these people. They're very much black and white thinkers. It's either this or it's that. It's right or it's wrong. It's black or it's white. Then there are people on the opposite spectrum that are very tolerant of ambiguity. You can pretty much recognize these people as well. They don't clean their rooms at all. They tend to go to Berkeley. You know what I'm saying? These are people that are very, hey, I'm going with the flow. Kind of what you mentioned of just kind of being, in a way. You seem to be more tolerant of ambiguity than intolerant.
Right.
Now, it's interesting because mathematically we know that people on the extremes tend to get to the same place in paranormal experience. In other words, it's people in the middle that you find that are can go either way, that they haven't made up their minds yet. But people that are either intolerant or very tolerant, they tend to be strong believers. Because even the tolerant people, they may have an experience and they don't know immediately what it is, but that means they're very tolerant of any explanation. Oh, it could be a ghost. It could be a cat. It could be a burglar. It could be my imagination. Oh, I don't know. But they seem to be wrapped up in the awe of the experience rather than getting so flipped out.
That's
but the end result is the same, and that is they still have an explanation. In this case, it could be any explanation. It makes me feel just fine because I'm just in awe of what it could be. So it's quite an interesting phenomenon because we tend to think of believers, strong believers and strong skeptics being on opposite ends of the continuum, and they're not. They're very much alike.
Wow. Okay. Now,
now you've done it, Jim. He's pointing his finger now. We're all in trouble.
Which finger is it? I mean,
it's my index finger.
It better not even go there.
So people when they experience phenomena, okay, and I don't mean like it could be something as mundane as water dripping in the dark, you know, as you're in a supposed haunted house. You're going to perceive that. And think about it completely differently than the person standing right next to you.
Maybe, maybe not. I don't know.
I mean, let's say, for example, you see a ghost, right? You're standing there, and this ghost walks through the hallway, and you and your buddy, your ghost hunting buddy, and you've got your cameras out, but this ghost walks by, and you're, like, in awe, so your jaws drop open, and you're like, hey, that was a ghost, but what it means to you, of course, is going to be completely different than what it means to your ghost hunting buddy. I mean, it's going to be taken in a hugely different manner.
It could be. I agree with you. It could be, but it doesn't necessarily have to be. This is one of the things that I've studied in depth, and that is just the nature of these experiences to begin with. There are about 8 different categories of experience a person can have, and they fall into 2 broad bases of buckets. You can have a subjective experience, We assume, like you, the example you just said, we're in a hallway, we're together, and you see a ghost walk by. Well, in many cases, actually, good, documented cases, one person can be there and see something, and the other person right next to them doesn't.
True.
Okay?
That is true.
So we call that focusing effects. And we don't often think of focusing effects as being very prevalent in haunts. We tend to think of them as more prevalent in poltergeists, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where something only happens or focuses around a particular individual. Only when little Sally, who's going through pubescence here and is having family problems, that's when the pots and pans fly around.
Mm-hmm.
It's only when she's awake and it's only when she's around. She's the agent, the focal person. Poltergeist experiences tend to focus around the presence of an individual or individuals. For who knows what reasons. In some cases, we know it's due to fraud. In other cases, we don't know why it is. Well, haunts are also people-focused as well. And we know a little bit about what personality and perceptual variables predict, who will have an experience and who will not, and what personality variables will predict what kind of experience you will have and what will not. It's very systematic, actually, when you look at this. So much so that I can predict. I can actually set up an investigation, and I can, after having them fill out certain personality measures, have people that have no knowledge of a location, I can predict where they will have the experience, in what room, and generally what kind of experience they're going to have, and in some cases, how many experiences they will have. Now, that doesn't mean that it's all tied to personality insofar as a personality trait is causing this to happen. Maybe it's just merely the means to an end, like a remote control. If you get on the right channel, you can perceive something that other people can't.
Mm-hmm.
My entire PhD dissertation was on a construct known as transliminality. And this has to do with a person's ability to be able to have unconscious material move easily into conscious awareness. And how do I explain this? To what degree a person also registers what's going on in the environment around them. These are hypersensitive people. And remember, the old name for psychics used to be sensitives.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still a word that is used by laboratory-oriented parapsychologists today, because they're not willing to say that it's psychic, they're not willing to say that it's parapsychological, but they all agree that, yes, they're sensitive. To what? I don't know. Maybe it's to human cueing, maybe it's to information that we don't have yet, like ESP or Psi. But sensitives is a very good word because, indeed, these are people that react differently to lights. What is a normal lighting level to you, they'll think is exceptionally bright.
Mm.
What is a low-level sound, they'll think that's exceptionally loud to me. These are people that can pick up on what's going on in the external world, and they're very good at picking up what's going on in their own bodies. These are people that score very high on measures of somatic complaints, hypochondriacal tendencies. So they're very in tune with themselves and the outside world, and they can pick up on cues that you and I miss. They're exceptionally good at that. And it seems that if you have that trait, you also tend to have other personality traits, and it gets very predictable from that point on. But I should also say this, and excuse me for rambling, but it's a very complex issue, and I hope I'm bringing that to bear to your listeners, and that is what we tend to think of as very simple haunt phenomena are not very simple at all. It's a very complex issue. They're subjective experiences, like I just said.
Mm-hmm.
These are experiences that tend to be private. Someone touched me. I have the feeling I'm being watched by an unseen presence.
Mm-hmm.
It feels cold, yet a thermometer doesn't show that. These are experiences that may or may not be shared with other people, but they tend to be private. Then there's objective phenomena. These are things that I don't care if you're a believer or a skeptic. The pan moved. I can measure that.
Mm-hmm.
I saw that. I have it on tape. Erratic functioning of equipment. When I go into a place of investigation and maybe my magnetometer's acting up for no apparent reason. Maybe I record sounds on tape. Maybe I have recordings on tape that I didn't hear before, sort of like the EVP phenomena.
Yeah, exactly.
These are objective manifestations. It doesn't matter what opinion you have on what caused those things. Something physical happened. Well, in haunt cases, we tend to think of those things as linked. That whatever caused me to feel I'm being watched was the same thing that caused that pan to move.
Mm-hmm.
And that is where people start making up stories. They start connecting the dots.
Mm-hmm.
People are exceptionally good at finding patterns in things, even when there aren't patterns to things. And the whole name of recurrent spontaneous psychokinesis, or RSPK, many parapsychologists feel that's the scientific name for poltergeist activity,
mm-hmm.
okay, which also includes private experiences like apparitions, bites, feelings of being watched. All of these things also occur in poltergeist experiences.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's hard to know where a poltergeist ends and a haunt begins and vice versa. But it's not spontaneous at all. Mathematically, we can show when an event is going to happen. And in fact, it gets very cool. It actually is musical. In other words, the timing of when something's going to happen in a poltergeist case it follows what we know in the physics world as a power law. It's very predictable, actually.
Okay.
And it goes according to a formula. And the same formula that describes the timing of poltergeist events is the same formula that describes music.
Really?
In other words, it happens in a musical pattern. People don't always perceive it that way, but it does. And that's why part of our attention is focused on poltergeist experiences, we think, or that's the why we think that we get these patterns of reporting, is because they are made to capture your attention, just like music captures your attention because you perceive order in random sound. I guess that's a simplistic way of describing what music is, ordered sound.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with poltergeist experiences. It captures our attention and it makes us think this is weird because it doesn't follow the same pattern of freak experiences. All of your listeners, I'm sure, have had the experience of, you know what, I'm in the shower, I thought I heard my name being called, but no one's in the room.
Mm.
Or, hey, I put my car keys right here last night. I know I did. Now where are they?
Mm.
And you find them someplace you don't even remember being last night.
Mm.
Well, when that happens to us during the day, during a typical week, we tend to just forget about it. That was just a freak occurrence. It was an accident. Who knows what had happened? But when those type of experiences happen in a place that we know to be haunted, now they take on new meaning. And they happen at a rate, and they happen at a rhythm that doesn't tell us that it's a freak event. The timing is different, and so we tend to, again, feel that there's meaning there because I see a pattern. Human beings find meaning in patterns.
Mm-hmm.
And when as soon as I find a pattern, I assume that there's something that's causing it that is not randomness. And that's the kind of cool thing about statistics. You can still have meaning in chaos just randomly. And so I know I sound like I'm going off on tangents here, but the gist is this. This issue of what kind of experience do people have or what kind of phenomena occurs in a haunt or poltergeist case is incredibly complex, and we don't even very well understand it before we can even understand what causes it. We are still trying to understand what are these phenomena and experiences that actually define when we are in a haunt or a poltergeist, and we're trying to define the various causes for these things. We know from research that there's many different reasons why someone can feel like they're being watched. From psychological to physiological reasons. A good example is Michael Persinger's work with electromagnetic fields impacting your limbic system, which is that seat of memory and fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
And certain levels of magnetic fields or different fluctuations in magnetic fields cause alterations in certain neurotransmitters, specifically melatonin and serotonin. And these are mood-altering neurotransmitters. And we are especially susceptible between the hours of midnight and 6 a.m. when our melatonin production is at its highest. And it just so happens that when electromagnetic activity from Earth faults or solar flares hit the Earth and we were impacted by this, you get greater reductions in neurotransmitters. You can get the feelings of being watched, have apparitions, smelling things that aren't there, basically akin to little non-threatening seizures.
Mm-hmm.
Epileptic seizures, in a way. We know this. We can reproduce it in the laboratory. We know this from case studies. We know this from statistical analysis of timing of poltergeist cases with rises in geomagnetic activity. But you don't always have to have geomagnetic activity and EMF sources to get that same effect. I can cause the same effect through suggestion. So it gets very complex when someone says, you know, I'm here, I'm standing next to my friend, I see a ghost walk by. That is not as clear-cut as it would seem. Even when people report experiences, and that's what we need to remember, these are experiences. And when we actually get to them as parapsychologists, we are generally three times removed. Because there's what the person experienced, which is a perception. Right? So right there, it's different than what really happened. It's a perception. Then there's how they remember it. And we know that encoding and memory can sometimes be quite faulty,
I guess,
way to say it. Okay,
yeah,
and then there's a way a person tells about their memory of a perception. Well, oh my God, now we're three times removed from what actually happened. And even if a person is very sincere, okay, you can still get, even though there might be small discrepancies, important discrepancies that can make all the difference between, I could have explained that, but the way you're telling me, yes, it does sound inexplicable.
Does it hurt or help a case to have multiple witnesses then?
That depends. Generally speaking, I would say it hurts a case.
Okay.
Because we know a thing called demand characteristics is at play. A lot of my earlier work, and I must have published, oh my goodness, 6 to 7 papers in psychology and psychiatry journals on context effects and hauntings. In other words, let me just let me give you an example. I'm here in Texas, okay? So the only haunts I have are haunted saloons, right? You know, so here. And what kind of apparitions do you think I see in a haunted saloon?
You would probably see, like, madams or the kind with the
cowboys,
maybe cowboys shooting each other.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, exactly. Now, let's say I was in New York State, and I went to a ballroom that was supposedly haunted. What experiences am I going to have in a ballroom?
You're going to see gangsters.
Yeah.
You might see gangsters. You might see, okay.
I mean,
you might see people wearing, you know, ballroom gowns, dancing. You might hear classical music. Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
But you always seem to see a scene that's consistent with the context around you. I've never had a case where I see a ghost of a cowboy in a ballroom. I never see a ghost of a, you know, like you're saying, a gangster in a haunted saloon.
Uh-huh.
Even though those buildings were not always saloons or ballrooms. It always seems, at least in about 70 to 80% of the cases that I have that I know are well documented now, there always seems to be a context effect. Another good example is, well, here's one. There was a case that I personally investigated where people kept smelling the scent of lilacs or roses. And actually, that's kind of popular. That and oranges seems to be very popular.
Cigarette smoke.
Cigarette smoke occasionally can happen, but generally flowers is something that I have in more of the what I consider very well investigated cases.
And I'll concur. And I'll concur with you on that too. I'll concur with you on that.
I've read a lot of stories.
It seems to always be flowery type scents, sweet scents, nice.
And another
and it's not just haunts and poltergeists. You also get the same thing in religious experiences with mystical experiences as well as apparitions of saints, the Virgin Mary. You also kind of tend to get that stuff. But coming back to the point. There was this one case, again, one of the major effects was a strong scent of lavender or lilac and in this one particular room. And the first thing that struck me when I went into the room was, guess what color the walls were? Freaking lavender.
Let me guess.
Okay?
They were purple. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting? Now, I, you know, you see that once, you're like, okay, again, all right, Jim, that's not very – okay, great. It worked this time, but how many cases does this really work on? So I spent 2 years looking at well-documented haunt cases to see if – what was experienced by the person, if it was congruent with the contextual variables that were available to the person.
Well, you know
and
what?
In about 70, 80% of the time, they are.
I want to shoot this in also. We did an investigation last summer at the Hanna House in Indiana. And one of the rooms, for example, this ties right in with what we're talking about here.
Contextual.
One of the rooms supposedly was Grandma's room.
Grandma's room, yep.
And you were supposed to smell a strong scent of roses in this room.
Yes.
Okay.
And I'm just, as you were just explaining this, that popped in my head for some reason. And I remember vividly that the comforter on the bed was roses. It was like a design of roses and things like that. Now, it may not be as dramatic as, like, you know, I smell lavender, and then you have a purple room. That seems like it may be, but there's still that same effect, though. I remember that vividly. There was a comforter, and that even the couch, like the couch was in there.
Well, there was a floral pattern.
It was floral patterns and stuff like
that.
So, I mean, that really explains a lot there, Jim.
Well, it certainly could, and these are cues that people generally don't think about consciously. But again, if you're the right personality type that, again, is very intolerant or tolerant of ambiguity, you tend to pick up cues like this even unconsciously, and you incorporate them in your experience. Now, you asked before, what about these multiple witness cases? Aren't that impressive? Well, they can be impressive. The best cases in my mind that are multiple witness are when these witnesses don't know each other, and they occur independently of each other over the course of years. When you have a large group of people that all report something the same night, I'm not impressed at all, because I can make that happen without a haunted house. I can induce a suggestion effect, and in fact, this is going to just, you know, kill you too. We already know what this effect is. It's called contagion effect. In fact, we know this a lot. It happens sometimes in high schools when people claim that they have food poisoning or that there's something in the air that's causing them to have breathing problems.
Mm-hmm.
And then everybody
happens to two or three girls, now suddenly four or five are infected. Now they're suddenly seven or eight.
Well, they take that to an extreme in Philadelphia. They had a bus crash, and there was only one person on the bus when it crashed, but there were about 50 or so when the police arrived, yeah.
Well, actually, we know this jumped onto quite a bit in haunt stuff.
So that kind of thing may happen as well. I'll tell you what, we have to take a quick break.
Sure.
Yeah.
So,
wow.
Hang on, Jim. We'll be back right after this with more Wow. Contagious talk with Dr. James Harrah.
Again, I'm melting down already. This sucks. We're halfway through the show.
Well, I have like eight things I want to ask.
Okay. All right.
So let's do the break so we can get to the ask another question.
We'll be right back.
Absolutely.
Cool.
Hey, I'm Yuri Geller, and right now I am transmitting a thought into your mind. Can you feel it? Yes, it is my website, www.urigeller.com. And guess what? I love Ghostly Talk. These guys, Scott, Doug, and Will, are supernaturally great.
We'll be right back. is Tommy Netspan from the Haunted Hate Walking Tour. Goes out every Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. And you can get your tickets at hauntedhate.com. And you're listening to Ghostly Talk with Scott L., Doug, and Will.
I'm Doug.
I'm Scott L.
I'm Will.
And we have Dr. Jim Horan on the phone right now still. I hope he's still here.
I'm still here.
Oh, good. He didn't
nice try, though, boys.
He's good.
Eek!
Click.
Yeah. We got an interesting conversation while we were on break.
Well, that's the thing. I'm like, if you want to go get some water, but do that in a minute, because I have a question.
And then that turned into like 6 minutes.
All 6 minutes were spent taking up the time like that.
Yeah.
I wondered, because your studies, because you've obviously studied, this from several different angles, several different, and very scientific. Mm-hmm. But what got you into it? Because you're so focused on exactly what we're trying to observe. And now, okay, to be fair, mm-hmm. the scientific method, number one, is observe, mm-hmm. right? And I think that's what 99% of us are doing. We're running around observing these things, and we're trying to capture these events or capture these anomalies mm-hmm. on film or tape or, some kind of instrument and even write down and document any subjective things. We're writing these down. There's groups putting them on TV and putting them in DVDs and putting them on the Internet. So we're doing subjective and objective observation. That's step one of the scientific method is observe.
Mm-hmm.
Then step two is form a hypothesis, and then step three is test. But you're targeting exactly the things that we want to know. I saw a ghost, and then you're like, why did it happen? How did it happen?
Yep.
Okay, so you're targeting exactly what we're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Why are you into that?
Well, it started, I'm going to be like the classical psychiatrist here, or psychologist. I'm going to blame my mother, okay? And I mean that literally, okay? Just imagine me, 7 years old, okay? And for my birthday, my mom gives me this book called The Golden Book of the Mysterious. I have it to this day. It's a hardback book that, to a seven-year-old, was great because it was just full of all these visual images, right, all these photographs, everything from the Loch Ness Monster to Bigfoot to UFOs. And on one page was this stark image of an apparition standing in a graveyard.
Ooh.
And it just captured my imagination of, is this real? Is this really real? I mean, people can live after death and all this stuff. And I was raised in a Catholic family, so we certainly had that belief that you live after death. But
mm-hmm.
that's different than being able to talk to people that died, right? And that they can return and you can interact with them.
Mm-hmm.
And that just stayed with me. Now, I have a general interest in all sorts of phenomena, and I investigate many different things. But haunts and poltergeists capture my attention more than anything else. Because in the parapsych world, we're used to laboratory research. There's been a big move away from the traditional psychical research, which actually started this whole ball rolling, right? Back in the age of the spiritualism, when parapsychologists were interested in the issue of life after death. Well, that has changed. We've now moved away from the seance room into the laboratory room.
Mm-hmm.
And what people are trying to do now is use statistics and well-controlled studies to see if there's something called psi, which makes people have ESP experiences, which makes them have PK or psychokinetic experiences, mind and matter interacting.
Mm-hmm.
But they're really trying to avoid this issue of life after death. And I wonder why, because these experiences of haunts and poltergeists, if it's not fraud and it's not conventional science, then this is telling us something incredibly important about the nature of man. Whether or not we live after life or not, whether or not this is evidence for life after death, this is telling us something very important about our capacities as human beings, because it's one thing to do laboratory research and do statistics and find out, well, yes, there's a small effect here that people can read little cards with symbols on them, but that's quite different than a pan floating through the air. You don't need statistics to see that.
Right.
Okay? So these experiences are on a level that blows away laboratory research, and that's why I think that these are the most important experiences for us to examine, because if they don't tell us something about human nature in a parapsychological sense, then they're also extremely important for informing us of why we're having these incredible experiences if it's not real.
Mm.
These inform models of imagination, cognition, and personality. And that's why I think my studies of these experiences have been so well received by the mainstream scientific community, because already scientists are studying these things. Psychiatrists on a daily basis work with people that hear things other people don't hear, right?
Yeah.
People that deal in anthropology are used to stories of ghosts and spirits and interactions. And so these experiences, more than any other in parapsych, have a shared overlap here with mainstream science. And if they're not evidence for something parapsychological, then they're extremely important for us to help refine our models of how our brains work, how perception works, how memory works. And so no matter which angle you look at these from, it's an important set of experiences to look at.
When you go to a mainstream science kind of convention or journal or something like that, and you start talking about, you know, ghost sightings and pans flying through the room, I know they're different experiences and they shouldn't be attached to each other now. But
Maybe not. We don't know. That's what I'm saying. We should make the assumption.
Why would they take any of that seriously? I mean, you would think that once they see the word ghost, or once they see the word, you know, PK, or you know, phenomena even, that they would be like, oh, that has, you know, nothing to do with the brain. So I'm not going to talk about it. I'm not going to read it. I'm not going to listen to that lecture. Well, you know, because it seems to me that the hardcore scientists are really into other stuff, you know, like you know, profiling,
more,
or
more,
you know,
more solid, more tangible
things.
Putting
people into bins, more tangible things.
Yeah.
Think, I mean, I didn't think, is this a really common occurrence, so common that they've opened up their eyes and said, okay, we've got to deal with this now, too?
Well, I guess my experience with journal editors and reviewers and the scientific community, because I don't consider myself a parapsychologist, I consider myself a social scientist.
Right.
Is I've never had any animosity whatsoever. I've only been offered with open arms.
Mm-hmm.
It's my experience with parapsychologists so that breaks down, because of what I'm saying about these experiences.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I think again, no, these experiences are very much accepted by mainstream scientists, not in a parapsychological sense, but it's a fact. 10% of people from the general population worldwide have seen apparitions. It's a fact.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, if you look at psychiatrists, one of the most common experiences that, for example, widows or widowers will have are bereavement hallucinations or bereavement apparitions. It's very well known. You could probably look up on any academic search engine for articles on bereavement apparitions and how to deal with people that have those experiences. You'll probably get about 1,000 articles.
Do they tend to just give them drugs and say, there you go, you'll be all
right? Not at all.
This?
It's a perfectly normal part of the grieving process.
Okay.
That's why I'm saying whether it's parapsychological or not is almost a moot point to some of the people in mainstream science, because it's a normal experience. We think of ghosts and all this stuff as just these far-out experiences and whatnot. No, they're actually not. It's actually quite common. If you personally have not had some sort of an unusual experience, you know someone that has. Okay.
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
You're at a party.
It's not just limited to ghosts, but I'm talking about the whole realm of what we would call anomalous experiences, from near-death experiences to seeing UFOs to, you know, out-of-body experiences to, you know, who knows, precognitive dreams, the most common type of psi experience ever reported. These are common experiences. That's why they have remained in the popular culture and the human imagination for as long as they have. Even if scientists wanted to ignore them, the general public wouldn't let them.
Because they
keep
happening.
They're just too common.
Yeah, they just keep happening.
So, of course, we study these things. But we study them to learn first about their phenomenology. What is going on and what patterns do we see in what people experience? And then we look for explanations, and we try to test those. And that's exactly what you said earlier on. The problem I have, for example, with a lot of ghost hunting groups is the fact that they don't test hypotheses. They go in already with the belief that we're here to find evidence for ghosts. Well, if you already walk into a place with your mind made up, you are dead. You might as well just turn around and walk out, because everything you're going to do is worthless from that point on.
Well, another nail in the coffin for us.
Witnesses, as soon as this idea of a contagion effect, people, again, you can't blame them, because it's our brains. We're hardwired to do this.
Mm-hmm.
But people look for evidence for stories they believe in, period.
Mm-hmm.
They do. You do this unconsciously.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a certain worldview, we are excellent at picking out information and bits and pieces of evidence that are consistent with what we believe in, and we ignore everything else. Well, we do this not just in this realm, but we do it in all aspects of our lives.
And what I find fascinating still, and this may go back a little bit on what we were talking about earlier, but it is a fascinating idea, if not kind of funny, too, is that, like you said earlier, if I lost my keys here in the house, just on a normal weekday thing, and I misplaced my keys, and I finally found them, like, oh, God, why'd I leave them in the refrigerator? Geez, that's really weird. You know, it could there could be a million different scenarios how that played out, but I'd be like, oh, you know, I was just being a dummy. I was thinking about something else, thinking about work or whatever. But then take me to... you know, the creepy haunted house on top of the hill with lightning bolts shooting down on top and stuff like that, where we have the scene set. You know, we've all seen the movies, and I think that's a lot to blame for a lot of this ideology we have now. And then I go up there, I start doing my thing up there, I lose my keys. Now, all of a sudden, I'm freaking out going, oh, my God, something has stolen my keys. And I find them in my pocket or something. You know, I mean,
somebody put them from where I left them into my pocket.
Yeah, you know, where it's that ideology which ties right into what you just said a second ago. When your mind's made up like that, you're going to look for things to try to prove that.
Exactly.
I find a big and that like I said a second ago, like that's another nail in the coffin for us because we keep saying this to people all the time. If you want to see ghosts, we will show you ghosts. It's not very hard.
Actually, it's not. You're absolutely right. It's very easy to cause someone to have an experience.
It's very easy. We'll get you so freaked out before we take you somewhere that you're definitely going to see something or experience something.
Exactly.
I mean, it's
that's why, I mean, I look at these people that claim to have evidence for ghosts, whether they're orbs in a photograph or something looks like an apparition or they have EVP recordings or this and that.
Mm-hmm.
And I always ask, well, what caused that? You know, how did that happen? Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know. Well, then why don't you just say you don't know? Don't quit calling a ghost. I hate the term paranormal, supernatural, mystical, whatever. It's better to just admit we're ignorant. We don't know. That's why we're studying these things, because we don't know. Instead of giving it a label like it's a ghost, it's an apparition, it's supernatural, it's paranormal. No, it's not. We don't know, period.
Can't we just say
someday we will know?
Can't we just say it's anomalous?
Same thing. Please. Anomalous just means we don't know.
Actually. That's what I prefer, too. That's what I keep telling them. We see pictures all the time, and people are like, I have a ghost on photo, Scott. And I'm like, okay, well, let's see here. Let's take a look at this thing. And we look at the thing over, and I go, well, you know what? Just by looking at it, I mean, it seems like it may be anomalous in nature. I don't know what it is. Nobody knows what it is. If we knew what it was, we wouldn't be doing this show right now.
Exactly.
If you had the ears and attention of an upswelling of folks running who make it their hobby and their drive to run around in cemeteries or run around in haunted houses, supposedly haunted houses, and run around and take photos and EVPs and develop new things that you can attach to a microphone to try and make them clearer and develop develop new instruments dealing with detecting magnetic fluxes instead of EMF fluxes. All these people with all this drive and all this ambition, if you had their ears and wanted to tell them something constructive to do, what would you tell them?
Constructive. Okay. Because I've had different experiences, both good and bad, with groups like this. And I used to think that they were basically harmless, that ghost hunting groups were at the most the equivalent of maybe Civil War groups that were, you know, they dressed up and they reenact, you know, things to keep history alive. And no, because I think that the ghost hunting groups are as much a social phenomena as it is thing for some.
Oh, I can attest to that.
Oh, absolutely.
And if we're really honest, it's also for at least the higher echelons of the management of these groups, it's about ego and money.
I have seen that.
Now, I shouldn't belabor that. That's all well and good. But my point of constructive criticism or remark won't sound constructive, but it would be this. If you really are interested in having science understand these phenomena, then stop meddling in it.
Mm.
Instead, all that money that you're using to buy magnetometers and the best thermometers and digital readouts, donate that to parapsychological organizations that can give that money, which is desperately needed, to real parapsychologists that are in a position to not only do proper studies, but publish those and get those in the attention of mainstream scientists. because it's only with the cooperation of mainstream scientists and a sharing of those ideas that we're going to get to the bottom of this. Amateurs should not tread where the professionals are. And I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean that wholeheartedly, sincerely, in a constructive way.
I can't think of any way not to take that negatively.
Well, I'm sorry, but let's face it. The America's Scariest Places and Most Haunted and Ghost Hunters, all these shows, they don't help our image. They simply don't. And parapsychology already shuns psychical research. By legitimate parapsychologists, okay?
Right.
So what do you think? You said yourself, too. As soon as mainstream scientists, when they see a journal submission, has the word ghost, what are they going to equate that with? The only contextual variable that they have to draw upon, and that is, oh, I've seen ghost hunters on TV before, I saw an A&E special. This stuff's all bunk, because some of these ghost hunting groups do not take a scientific approach. Certainly some do. Some try to do very good work, and I bet some do very good work, given the resources and the education that they have.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not to say that's a substitute. They are acting as a calling card for this aspect of parapsychology, and that's bad because it gives the wrong impression of, first, what we do, what we found, and what we believe. We already have theories that we can test for haunts and poltergeists. In fact, in the past 15 years, there's probably been more surgeons in scientific understanding of haunts and poltergeists than in every aspect of parapsychology. And a lot of that has been published in mainstream journals. So when these people go in to say, well, you know, I'm trying, you know, you're saying, we go in first to observe and then create, you know, a hypothesis. Well, you're right. You first need to try to find out what you think might be going on in a given case.
Mm-hmm.
But we already have very well-tested hypotheses on what's probably causing probably 98% of these experiences.
And we've heard
this.
And
if people had that background knowledge and they knew how to test it, you know, that would be different. But these groups don't because they are competing with different agendas. Okay? These tend to be social outlets, ego outlets, and money outlets. That is not the scientific paradigm. And unfortunately, I've also tried to work with these types of groups, and when people work from different agendas, you get nothing done. So I know it may sound negative, but I mean it wholeheartedly, and that is if you really are truly concerned with a scientific understanding of these, then help people that are actually in a position to get a scientific understanding of these.
That's an interesting outlook. I mean, and I do – Doug made a good point. I mean, but it's more or less it's I don't even know how to explain it. I'm totally shocked.
I am in shock.
I am in shock,
but
at the
same time,
yeah.
I completely understand. I mean,
we
didn't just talk to three weeks worth of parapsychologists,
mm-hmm.
and they all seem to concur.
They all seem the same. They share the same opinion.
Yeah.
Where
and some don't actually. Some think that parapsychologists should reach out to ghost groups. Because it's the ghost groups that are the ones that are getting the tips on probably the good cases.
Mm-hmm.
And then if we had that pipeline to the general community about a good source of good cases, well, then we could be, you know, two steps ahead. But unfortunately, I don't. Some people disagree with me. I personally don't feel, and I hope I'm wrong, that these two groups will get along with each other and that there will be a constructive output from that. I say that out of personal experience. There's personal bias there. I've had very negative things happen with groups such as this, and I certainly cannot characterize all of them that way. Just like I can't characterize all parapsychologists that are sincere and serious. There are some very awful parapsychologists out there that are also operating under biases and do sloppy work and give us a bad reputation.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's going to be up to you guys, you know, to prove me wrong. You know, and to actually make inroads so the next generation of people that are going to take over this field of study can have the benefit of what you guys have learned from.
Mm.
You know, I have no doubt that you guys have some very good cases, things that scientists probably would love to study. And you guys probably have insights from use of equipment that probably we don't have because we so very rarely get to study good cases.
Mm.
And parapsychology is a field that is extremely underfunded. There's probably, in fact, I only know 3 full-time working parapsychologists in the world today.
Then you know
that is their job to work.
Then you know 2 more than I do.
Okay.
So
money is scarce to begin with. Let alone if you have any amount of money, then the thing is, what do you do with it? Where do you find good cases? Cases that are not at well-publicized ghost sites, but that are at families that have told people privately. Something's going on here. We don't know what it is. It's disturbing us. We need a resolution. Those are the cases we need to be looking at, especially ones that seem to have no apparent conventional explanation. I don't care that it's psychology, EMFs, or fraud. But when you can rule those major 3 things out, man, those are the cases we need to be studying to see if there is anything about these experiences that is special after we take away the psychology.
It does come down to a lot of that, too. You made a very good point, and I mean, I'm not going to sit here and knock any ghost groups because, you know, I go out and do my own research myself, but I found that, you know, we've all been part of that. All three of us have been part of that here as far as the club. Or whatever you want to make.
I'm not just the president. I'm off. Yeah.
Yeah. it's very hard. I've seen, you know, groups. You do have to have someone, I think, that has to spearhead the group and to get you going in a certain direction. But I have.
But there comes a point when all of a sudden they want to make it a business.
Well, yeah. You know, I can make a living doing this.
And I don't think that's bad necessarily. I think that's wonderful that someone's trying to raise money to do what they love, and especially if they're putting it back in the business to try to advance science.
But if they're putting it back in the business.
That's exactly happening.
Yeah.
I see this thing like, hey, become a certified ghost hunter in our 6-week course online.
Ah.
That's absurd. There is no such thing as a certified ghost hunter because we don't even know ghosts exist. That's insane.
I thought I was an idiot for saying this like a year ago, Jim. I thought I was dumb for saying, okay, I said the same thing.
Yes, you did.
I said the same thing. I'm like, okay, wait a minute. I saw this article, this ad that said, okay, you can become, you know, you can get a PhD in ghost hunting in only like 2 weeks, and you have to pay $5,000, and you know, but you will be a certified. You can refer to yourself as a doctor then, or whatever you want to call it. And I thought the idea, just like you, was completely absurd. I'm like, we're dealing with things that we have no idea how they work. We don't know what's going on yet, and either the people that are teaching these courses, I think. So I share your opinion on that, and that's my opinion too. I think that's ridiculous.
Yeah, and there is no such thing as a PhD in ghost hunting, and there's only one person in the United States I know of that has a PhD in parapsychology, and it was done through an individual option program at Stanford, I believe, in 1978. Mm. There is no such thing as a PhD in parapsychology. The closest thing is University of Edinburgh in Scotland has the Kessler Unit, and unfortunately, Bob Morris, who headed that unit, died a while back. He was a great champion for psi research, and as well as for research into conventional explanation for these experiences. I was just over there at Edinburgh with Dr. Richard Wiseman doing some stuff, and I can tell you that unit now only has two full-time people, and when they put students through under a PhD program, there are PhDs in psychology. It's not parapsychology because, again, if you don't have an understanding of psychology or physics, okay, you're nowhere with this stuff. You have to have one or the other. Mm-hmm. Preferably, you should have a lot of psychology because that comes into a play no matter what you're talking about here. But this thing about certified ghost hunting or ghost courses or PhD in this, no such thing. People should never believe those people. In fact, if you run across them, run the other way as fast as you can. Because these are the people that are probably doing the most damage to our field.
And if there's anything anybody's going to take away from this conversation we've had with Jim tonight, I hope it's that. I hate to see people, and I don't want to turn this into a big fight with the people that are charging. This isn't the Jerry Springer show, but the thing is I agree with Jim on that. I think we all agree down here, too, that it's like, okay, look, save your money.
Well, you got to remember, I am ambiguous, remember? I even outed myself by telling that dream, right?
Yeah,
that I'm ambiguous.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I can see why people would do it. And I don't think they have ulterior motives. I don't think they have negative intentions. I think people do it so that they can simply say, okay, this person underwent some kind of training.
Yeah.
What possible training could that be? Because if they're already assuming that there are ghosts and that you can hunt them and this equipment will document them, then I would question their very training. They're not trained as scientists. They're trained under some propaganda machine.
But they've got
they have
foundation.
Like,
I'm going in. I conduct my gathering of evidence in this manner. It's all written down, and I've studied it and done it over and over. At least there's some level of consistency. Then, whether it's wrong, I mean, you know, practice sometimes makes perfect, but quite often it just makes permanent. You know,
yeah.
And maybe they're
absolutely.
Maybe they're just making their practice permanent instead of perfect, but at least there's something written that says, you know, well, at least I looked at the stuff. I don't know. I can see it. However, I am inclined to agree that perhaps it is on the...
I just don't like... I'll be quite honest.
It is on
the
shady side.
That's what I was just going to say. I don't like people trying to get a quick buck. That's
there
my,
is
that's
no
my
overriding board of, you know, anybody saying, okay, well, here are the guidelines.
Exactly.
There is no nationally accredited board or mm-hmm. anything like that.
Yeah,
so.
And that's the big problem right there. Jim, we need to thank you for coming on the show, though. Thank you so much.
Hey, my pleasure, guys.
Wow.
Take care.
There's so much.
Wow, yeah.
We packed like 3 days of information. I think it ended like 1 hour.
I absolutely thoroughly enjoyed it.
Thank you, Jim, so much.
My pleasure, guys.
We will talk to you soon. Thanks, Jim.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye.
Do we have to do another hour? Oh, my God. I want to go home. Oh, I am home.
I wanted another hour with Dr. Moran.
We'll have him come back. We'll have Jim come back.
I hope so.
We'll have Jim come back.
I hope so, because I wanted to ask him about the church making, you know, they're having the classes on more
mm-hmm.
exorcists and mm-hmm. things like that, you know, but
yeah.
I just didn't.
We'll do it again. We'll have to. Like any guest we have on here, we always have more questions. We'll have to have Jim come back again. Why don't we take a quick break, though?
Yes.
We need to take a break here.
And let's get Dr. Ken on.
Dr. Ken, because I think we're going to be hearing a lot of the same things.
I wonder.
That's all right, though. We're going to hear it from a ghost hunter now.
Yeah, this is from a ghost hunter.
This is from a whole different side of the thing. This isn't from a parapsychologist. This is from somebody who does the same work that a lot of us do to listen to the show and the people that host this show. So let's take a quick break. This is Ghostly Talk. I'm Scott L.
I'm Doug.
I'm Will.
We'll be right back.